Are there any questions about what we read?
I have a question, but it's going to be even more interesting as we think about adding the Los Ecos or the chant or the sound, and that makes the breath even more effective.
Mm-hmm.
What lazifas you use?
Lazifas are a Sufi term for mantra, mm-hmm. for prayer. Well, that's a whole other exercise of circulating a thought on the breath, which is a very useful activity. And in fact is a form of prayer.
But it made me understand more how the two kind of work together in
mm-hmm.
what you've read.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
I guess a question.
Yes.
In Anayat's view, is there ever a time when chaotic breath is of use, or is it always useful, or is the emphasis always on breath that has some definite rhythm as being the useful breath?
So the question is in Hazrat Anayat Khan's teachings, is there ever a prescription for a more erratic breath, or is always the teaching about what was the last part? Rhythm
and
balance?
Well, choosing some appropriate rhythm for whatever you're doing, but always rhythmic.
I'm not saying he didn't, but as far as I know, and in terms of my conversations with his son, Hidayat Anayat Khan, I don't recall that ever an erratic breath would be given. I mean, he was a musician. We have to understand that. And I'm also trying to think in any yogic system or in Tibetan practices, I don't recall that I've ever been given anything like that. Anyone else?
Uranus. The walk and turn of Uranus is rather erratic.
For the breath of fire.
Fire breath,
yeah.
Certain yogic practices of the fire breath is
still rhythmic.
It's still very rhythmic, though.
But it is dense. It's dense and rhythmic.
He knows that one.
Yeah, but it's not erratic. It's not.
Oh my God.
That's not good.
Just the thought of that.
Yeah, it makes you feel crazy. Well, it makes people that are like that are usually agitated or mentally out of balance. I was reading something. I should read it to you. It's not really entirely on the subject, but it would be useful for you to hear his description of insanity. Would you like to hear that to see how many of us fit that description?
No.
You know, it's interesting that laughing seems to be somewhat erratic in breathing, which is kind of delightful.
It relates a lot to the breath of fire, though, I think, which mm-hmm. fire relates to joy. Do you think?
I guess
it's still rhythmic.
Frying is also frying can be very erratic,
still
but
rhythmic.
It can also be very cathartic and healthy.
Sometimes
we don't acknowledge grief very well in this society,
but it still seems rhythmic too.
I think it does too.
Sometimes it's I've had it not being rhythmic.
And when it's not, and when it's not, how do you feel? Exhausted.
Exhausted and even worse.
And even more confused, perhaps.
A practice that was one thing I thought of when I asked that question was, I think it's a Rajneesh practice. There's a certain point in some of his movement meditations that is called chaotic dance or something like that. And that's obvious. It will not be a prescription.
You know, those things, if I may say so, those things are often leading into a trance-like state.
That's the next in the sequence.
And here we're not trying to get there at all. And in fact, I think sometimes the rhythmic motion of zikr does the same thing. Which, you know, Hazrat and Icon never did the zikr in that way. And a lot of Sufis don't do it in the way that we've been taught. So that's not a criticism, it's an observation. Here we're not trying to get into a trance-like state. We're not trying to escape anything. We're trying to become very conscious, very awake, very aware, so that we can heal ourselves towards some sort of wholeness, and ultimately we can be of benefit to others. You know, this isn't just a path where we're trying to get somewhere and like, nan-nan-nan-nan, look where I am and everybody else is back there. I mean, we're trying to, you know, if we can be somewhat in control of our own breath and our consciousness, how that's, you know, an example, I was talking with a gentleman that has found us, and he's in Washington, D.C. He's all alone, but I hope you all get to meet him one day. He's been really searching, and he feels he's found his place with the Sufis, and universal Sufis, not other kinds of Sufis who are also doing their thing, but it's different, and it's okay to say it, I think. But the point is that he said to me that there was a man that he felt connected to. And why did he feel connected to that person? He said, I remember every time I'd be in the room with him, he didn't say anything, but it was just the way he was. And I suspect it had something to do with, and this is his words, he hasn't studied the breath, his magnetism of breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he knew that somehow. And when we say that someone makes us feel a certain way, why is that? Halima?
I had an experience the other day with one of my clients, and I was hoping that you would find that insane.
I have it right here.
Because I felt myself becoming her emotions, and I immediately realized that I wasn't breathing properly. It was very erratic and very, you know, I felt her craziness pervading me and realized, you know, we need to focus here, we need to, you know, relax, take a breath, and, you know, that's what we did together.
Yeah, because sometimes they say the current of the breath can be like a large stream influencing a smaller stream. And if our stream of breath isn't strong, we'll get in the stream of another person's breath and absorb that rhythmic pattern. And pretty soon, we're in that with them. Yeah.
This is an observation that's becoming clear to me now, that in the past, when in the presence of people who have particularly pronounced control issues, and everybody has some control issues, everybody has some projection, that's what we do.
Yeah.
But there are certain people who stand out for that, mm-hmm. that everybody notices when they're in their presence. Mm-hmm. The control issues, the projection, the insistence upon dominating the decorum. I've never known a person like that whose breath isn't just all over the map. Mm-hmm. It's big, but it's chaotic. Mm-hmm. It's like it's in a constant state of panic. And what I'm observing now is just a very, very new beginner at this is, for example, in driving. Mm-hmm. There's the habitual repetitive thought that occurs when somebody pulls in front of me. I won't repeat any of those thoughts. But there's a contraction around that. I would notice. I started to notice finally that my breath changed when that happened.
Good.
So on the way over, as much as I wanted to be on time, someone pulls in front of me, and the miracle was I was able to continue to breathe with the awareness that I was breathing, and the energies instantly diffused. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, that was perfect. Mm-hmm. So this is helping me understand the rhythm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Hazrat and Icon. So here we go. This is also, those of you that are in healing, you know this. I mean, I think. you know, that's the premise of healing in this path, is the magnetism of the breath and being able to use the breath. We don't even need to use our hands. We don't need to use our words. We don't need to use touch. It can just be through the breath. And, of course, this is the premise of the absentee healing service that some people participate in. Do you understand? Okay. So here, and this is on teachings which are called Shafiat, which have to do specifically with healing. And so this is the psychical nature of diseases. This is the subject, and there's a whole range of them. But the nature of insanity. See if the shoe fits. There are, no doubt, many physical causes of various aspects of insanity, but a keen study of the subject will prove the fact that insanity is mostly due to mental causes. Some lack of balance caused by intensity or excess of a certain thought and feeling is found at the root of every cause of insanity. Okay, here we go. Talk about the habitual patterns. Let's start to look at them, because next step might be insanity. We all want to be aware of that. You know, what are we habituated to? So here again he says, some lack of balance caused by intensity or excess of a certain thought and feeling is found to be at the root of every cause of insanity. I'll go on. The physician fails to cure such cases, especially the one who traces the cause of insanity in its outer manifestations and in the physical body. Every cause has an external effect, and yet it is a mistake to take the effect for the cause. Every cause has an external effect. Of course we can blame people, places, situations, whatever. Of course there are those things. Every cause has an external effect, and yet it is a mistake to take the effect for the cause. The outer effect doesn't have to do with the cause. Therefore, it is not generally a medicine or even surgical operations, which of course they used to do lobotomies, or any external applications that can be of great use. It is more the work of a healer than of a physician to cure insanity. Like every disease, insanity could easily be cured in its earlier stage. And it is the work of the healer, again, to recognize the signs of insanity in their primary state. For such signs are not noticed in a person ordinarily. They are passed over as something funny about a person, or queer. You know the term, what he means by that term. Odd. The first step to healing insanity is to get at the root of the complaint by association with the subject. And as soon as the root of the complaint is touched, a great relief is brought already. You see, we have to get at the root of it. And in Buddhism, we talk about that too. We have to cut the root of the affliction. You know, and it's like a weeds, of course. If we just cut the top off, doesn't matter. We have to dig the root out. Okay. And as soon as the root of the complaint is touched, a great relief is brought already. I mean, how many times have you felt something has gnawed at you, and then as soon as you've been able to sort of name it, all of a sudden it's like, wow, the jack is out of the box, you know. the scary stick horses out of the dark closet, you know, it's like, whoa, that's all that is. You know what I mean? Now I can deal with it. Naturally, insanity being a mental disease, thought power alone is the remedy for its cure. There you go. How easy is that? And how difficult. Naturally, insanity being a mental disease, thought power alone is the remedy for its cure. And in other places in the teachings of Hazaran Knight, Connie talks about we have lines in our mind, like, a, you know, then it was a phonograph. I mean, it's too bad we don't have those things anymore. But, you know, like in a phonograph needle, when it, you get a, or a an album, then it gets the scratch, the needle just keeps going there. And he says we have to erase those lines in the mind. And I am sure that the breath is one of them. But also he says thought power alone is the remedy. So when we see ourselves thinking that thought, we have to pull ourselves away. We have to pull ourselves back. Here I am again. I'm going round and round on my hamster wheel. Now I'm going to move to another hamster wheel maybe for a little while. Or I'm going to stop that. I'm going to cut that. Do we understand? It's so important.
The breath.
You talked about it in your class.
What's that?
I can't remember if you talked about it in your class, but that is impossible to think about two things at the same time.
Yeah.
And with that, I've been using that lately.
Yes.
And when those obsessive thoughts come up, and you're just be like, think daisies. And that's just been my key little thing that's
yeah.
going out. And just to give my mind something else to think about.
Right.
The breath sometimes can.
Well, that's okay if you're, I mean, you know, visualization, you're artistic, so maybe that works for you. Mm-hmm. But we have to just stop it. We have to just stop it. We have to, we really have to try to control this. Huh?
You can just gnaw away at you.
Oh, my God. Yes.
At the beginning of the year when, you know, the different TV stations or whatever, I don't know, talking about, you know, making new resolutions and start opening fresh and new. I mean, you know, here's this doctor, he's talking about the actual pathways in your brain change. I mean, it's an actual physical change. Mm-hmm. Like, when you do something differently for a certain period of time, it actually is a physical change that happens. I mean, so this is not, it's not just woo-woo-woo-woo, it's real.
Well, and there, and that Joe and I are very interested. We're following that new field of neuroscience, and we're following the teachings at the Mind Life Conference that happens, you know, once one major one a year and a smaller one. And you know, those proceedings are people from so many different fields of medicine saying the same thing. But in neuroscience, they're being able to map the activity of the brain. And they're finding, and of course they're using Tibetan monks who are really master meditators, but they're finding that there's physiological things, that there's this left frontal part of the brain that actually, when we, when people that suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's, this becomes very thin. And in meditators, and it's in the left front part of the brain, but in meditators that area is thick. It's like it's been exercised. And it helps, and then they are running all kinds of experiments. Like, they'll be, they're all hooked up to these electrodes, and they'll do a loud sound, like a gunshot. And they're checking for a startle reflex to see how balanced and anchored they are in the breath. And hardly at all is there a, you know, one of these. I mean, they just are in the breath. You know, they're completely focused. And having to do with what you said, Lynn, one of the training of the mind techniques is there are these series of sayings, and then there's these vast commentaries, but it says do something different. So daisies, thinking about daisies is doing something different. Sometimes for me, I just leave the house. I go look at to the museum and look at something pretty, or you know what I mean? I change it up a bit. You just do something different.
Do the breath practices and do some mantras.
Yeah. Robin?
Well, I, this summer there was this doctor who came and did a presentation for a group, and it's art, and it opens up the frontal lobes of the brain, and he showed us how it was done. It was unbelievable. So I got to experience the session, mm-hmm. and then I realized at the very beginning of the session, it opens the breath up,
yeah,
and the body starts moving, just unbelievable, and just did it right away. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that a lot of times these frontal lobes are closed because of so much fright, so much fear in our body. We're not in that same mindset as we were in the past when we had to go and hunt for food.
Right.
So we are associating this fear in our everyday life with things that are happening out there. And what this session does is helps to get back to this breath. I just thought of that.
Yeah, it's relating. It's all relating. It is really. It all relates.
And I just felt like how wonderful everything just went away. All of the release went away. That's exactly how I felt when we were doing that practice as well.
Good. Yeah. So you can do it yourself. You don't have to have the doctor do it.
Oh, no, I don't know anymore.
Yeah, good, good, great. I'm glad you shared. Thank you.
Thank you.
Karina Gita, you've been wanting, you've had your hand up.
Well, I just wanted to go back to the purification breaths, because I think what we're talking about and looking at the practice of the purification breaths, and having done them in the manner before without the phrase upon the breath, there's significantly, and it kind of relates to what Heather was saying, for me there's a significant difference in the practice, and Rashida said it as well, when we place another element of concentration with the breath. So if we're placing a visualization with the breath, which Hazrat Nikon uses with the practices, we place a sacred phrase upon the breath. Mm-hmm. It engages all, even movements. Mm-hmm. Like in the zikr of Hazrat Nikon, there are very simple movements. These things come together to place the concentration of the physical and the mental in rhythm with the breath. Mm-hmm. And for me, that has been a significant difference in the practice of the purification breaths, because it brings everything mm-hmm. to the breath and working with the breath. So there's less that tendency to for the mind to jump or things of that nature.
And I know with you sometimes get prone to like bronchial stuff or throat stuff, and you haven't had any of that since you've...
I haven't been sick this semester.
Knock on wood, but it's been wonderful. I mean, she's really, you can feel the life force in her. You know, she's strong and really, it's really working. You can see the living testimony there.
Lynn? I have a theory.
What's your theory?
I have never heard it expressed, but it's about smoking and people that smoke and cigarettes, and you know, it tickles, you know, when they breathe down into their bronchioles and all, and that you know, it's very difficult. They say it's very difficult for these people that do smoke to stop. And my theory is that you need to run or do deep breathing, because you've given this tickling sensation up from the smoke going into your lungs, and you need to exchange it, because. Or maybe that's how you would never get into it in the first place. But that's my theory, is that you're getting this going in. There's rushing in and out.
I think that's true. I always tell my students that smoke, I'm big on trying to get them to stop, and I've been successful with some of them. Not my Sufi students, but my college students. So I always tell them, just go out and take a big drag of air, you know, instead of a big drag of a cigarette.
30 minutes.
And you'll save yourself a lot of money, and I won't have to hear any complaints about how much your art supplies cost.
You'll be able to see this little person's hands here. She's standing in front of
it. Oh, yes.
It's interesting that everybody is talking about neurology, because I'm actually working in a postdoctorate in clinical neurology right now. And I was giving a talk on addictionology the other day, and it's all about the habituation to an insanely chaotic, abnormal pattern of some sort. It doesn't matter what substance it is, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or recreational or prescription drugs or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's about doing something that can consistently break the habituation. And it was really interesting that this one fellow who was in the class just was not getting that addiction is about habituation. It doesn't matter what substance it is. And it can be relationships, it can be sex, it can be exercise, it can be anything. Food,
gambling,
shopping, anything. Okay, it's the habituation and how it alters the neurotransmitters and literally starts to create almost like hardwired pathways in how the lobes of the brain communicate with midbrain, then down the brainstem into the rest of the body. You can't just think about conscious thought just being in the brain. It's the entire body and every cell memory. And that's why it's so difficult for so many people to break an addiction many times, is because they don't find a strong enough way of breaking it, breaking that pattern, and then being able
true.
To stick with it.
And I'm going to get back to these teachings here, because I think that's what we're getting indications of how to get, how to do that. How to do that.
And breathing is a big part of the clinical practice.
Yeah, I would suspect that it would be. But I'm going to continue. Would anyone like for me to continue with this little teaching on insanity? Or are we all trying to avoid the subject? Do you know, it's real interesting how talkative people have gotten around this.
Well, so, because we all have experience with insanity.
I know, we live in an insane world.
Much, I don't have that much experience with breathing.
Yeah.
I know conscious breathing.
Consciously, yes, I understand. I'm teasing you.
But I come across something very briefly in my reading. I think it might be one of the primary insanities in our society was the insane thought that punishment makes anybody better.
Yeah, that's true. And we should be teaching them all how to meditate, believe me. I really believe that's true.
Yeah, that's what came up for insanity this week. Mm-hmm. It's not that I didn't know it, but that it was just nobody questions it.
Yeah.
Out yonder.
Okay, I'm continuing now. Loss of memory, confusion, puzzle, instantaneous temper, and passion. All these are signs of the beginning of insanity. Shall we go through
that
again?
Read those again?
Loss of memory.
Sure.
Confusion.
Been there, done that.
Puzzle or puzzlement. Instantaneous temper and passion.
That's so also an imbalance. I scored 100.
All these are signs of the beginning of insanity. Insanity is inherited from the family, but it can be traced in several weaknesses and vices.
Yes, what did you say?
Can.
Is in. But it can be traced in several weaknesses and vices.
Oh, you said is inherited from the family?
Yes, it does say
so
that.
So these weaknesses are and vices are inherited?
Insanity is inherited from the family, but... It can be traced, but it's not and,
okay.
Or it is traced, but it can be traced in several weaknesses and vices. Mm-hmm. Among these, drink. Among these, drink and fondness for drugs and unnatural habits, not sleeping right, not drinking right, not exercising right, too much worry. Got any worry warts in the room? Anxiety and allowing melancholy thoughts to develop in nature. These are all things that cause insanity. So, of course, an excessiveness of these.
Well, we're basically all insane to the extent that we're dealing with reality up in here anyway.
The work of the healer is first to catch the primary cause of insanity. Of course, we can do this for ourselves, and that is loss of memory. It is caused by weakness of the mind. The mind has not sufficient power to bring forward the thought entrusted to it at the command of the will. It is this which may be called loss of memory, and it must be healed and cured in its very beginning. And the primary stage is the extreme activity of mind. And the primary stage, this is the beginning, is the extreme activity of mind, which results in an extreme thoughtless anger or passion, and then when its spell is past, repentance comes. So like doing, you know, and then it's like, oh my God, I shouldn't have done that.
When he's saying passion, that would incorporate desire, I assume.
Anything that we cling to or grasp to through an attachment could be considered a passion, I would think. This is very difficult for us because we're so seduced in this culture, and we are told, grab all the gusto, you know, be all you can be.
Find your passion.
You know, I mean, we are really seduced by all that, and we are absolutely convinced that we're going to be happy.
It's external.
It is completely external. And that happens with us and other people too. We get passionate about them, you know, we're in love with them, they're everything wonderful, and then they're not, you know, and then they don't even look the same or smell the same, or you can't even tolerate being in the same room. I mean, what's that? That's passion. That's how he's, that's a description of it. Now, hopefully none of us do that with people, but it happens. We know it does. This should be avoided at its beginning, this whole idea of this passion and anger and this extreme activity of the mind. Guilty conscience, fear of consequences, doubting tendencies, all such things are like fuel to the fire of insanity. He's giving us some really strong stuff to think about here.
Would you read that?
Guilty conscience, fear of consequences, doubting tendencies, all such things are like fuel to the fire of insanity. A pure, thankful, useful life. A constant thought of appreciating things and avoid blaming things and people and conditions. All these help to keep away the germ of insanity. A pure, thankful, useful life. A constant thought of appreciating things and avoid blaming things and people and conditions. All these help to keep away the germ of insanity.
Was this written?
Well, he died in the 20s, 1920s.
It sounds so cutting edge.
Yeah. It's very cutting edge. I mean, the truth is the truth. You know what I'm saying?
I know.
I mean, and in one way, it's extremely simple, but who can really do it?
It's time to be a monk.
And just hearing it.
No, you don't have to be a monk. Believe me, in the monasteries, and I've lived there, these conditions also arise. This is humanity. This is the plight of humanity. And we participate in humanity when we have these struggles. But we can also elevate ourselves, and in doing so, we can elevate others. I'm convinced of it. This is not a club I'm a part of here. this is something that I really believe in. I see how it changes people's lives if they really use the practices. And I believe, you know, that this, anything is a complete path. I keep preaching to people, pick something and stick with it. Don't chop around.
Get away from the television.
Well, we could blame the television, but we can use the television to actually invoke in us a compassion for the condition of the world. And we can also then use it for an agent for prayer. I mean, anything can be used for our enlightenment. I really believe that. Anything.
I'm passionate, too, about this, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
I believe that there's so much out there that we can blame, of course, and I don't want to blame anybody or anything. It's just that is, I have to learn to allow for that to be an avenue
right.
of growth. You know, in my practice of remaining in a state of balance.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where the practice of discernment comes in. Knowing when not to be getting into a place of being in the too passionate part and it starts creating a balance. If you see something for just what it is at face value or don't, you know, place a lot of emphasis on it, it doesn't have to become destructive, it can be a constructive tool.
What I'm hearing him say is that, you know, just the thing many people said is the power of positive thinking. And every intent, everything we think
has a vibration.
Has a vibration.
That's the point.
Yeah, and every time we feel we're sliding back into that little groove to reintroduce the positive, to make that the present moment positive as possible.
The thing is there is, like Robin says, we can't also be in denial. And I don't think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I do want to bring that to light. The fact is that there's a lot of stuff going on. There always has been. There probably always will be. Those of us that are here are interested in elevating consciousness. We are interested in doing our very best to participate in an enlightened lifestyle, and you know that can contribute, I hope, to an enlightened society in one of our lifetimes. But the trick is, even those things that are negative are also so useful, because in their pure essence, it is all energy. And whatever comes at us, we use it, we see the raw energy of it, and we use it for our enlightenment.
This is like a computer. You can use it either way.
Anything can be that way.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do, and what I also want to emphasize about what you said, Halima, you know, we have those scientists, that Dr. Omoto, I think. I keep mentioning him. I feel like a broken record. But it's a good example. Where he's done those studies about the vibration of both the written word, music, and the audible sound. And then, you know, writing that on a vial, even writing the word on a vial of water, doesn't matter the language, that the water absorbs the vibration, and when that water is frozen, they're observing the crystalline results. And the most beautiful, geometric, balanced crystals come from words like love and gratitude. To me, that's a clue. You know, and if you're telling, you know, you put another kind of word there, there's more of an aberrant, out of balance form that evolves. If we're that much water, what are we doing? So, I'm saying, because I know it's also true, we all have tapes. We all have scripts. But we have to grow up and overcome blaming other people, blaming the past. Everyone was doing the best they could. Now we're adults. We have to re-script things. We have to give ourselves a new script. Yes?
What I'm hearing in this is that with this rhythmic breathing, with this practice and with this attention to the vibrations, my circle of acceptance can expand, my sphere of acceptance can expand to be very accepting of all these things I've defined as negative, as being wrong or should or shouldn't out there. And as my circle of acceptance is expanding, it seems almost paradoxical that I'm less and less externally referent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not self and other. It just is. It's not always that. And I keep saying to people also, you know, this idea of we can't be in both fear and love at the same time. They're absolutely opposing. It's like you were saying, Heather, about you have to just, if you notice that and you're in that fear contracted state, you see, now you use the breath to expand, open. So the breath can do that. You know, that in the Sufi terms we call it kabat and basat, contraction and release. The breath naturally does that, you see. So we notice we're contracted, we just release. What do we get contracted around? You know, what are we holding on to? It sounds so easy. I know it's a process. But I'm here to support that process. I know it works. I guarantee it. And I know that these are meaningful teachings. I trust them. And I think if we trust them, they also work. So I don't care what it is. You know, I love the Mahabharata, that great epic Indian epic of the little boy that wanted to study to be the master archer and couldn't because he was a slave boy, and he built the effigy of a teacher out of, you know, mud, and then he practiced in front of that effigy every day, and he became the master archer because of his belief.
And also the practice in that word, the practice of the breath, the practice of harmony, practice of internal harmony, no matter what's going on in the world or around you. The Buddha teaches that all of life is an experience so that we can maintain the harmony of the heart no matter what. And the practice of maintaining harmony and maintaining joy and maintaining a rhythmic breathing, it's all the same kind of thing.
It is. It's a cycle within cycles. I mean, my own teacher, Comtal Rinpoche. Okay. Can you turn the heat up a bit, honey? Joe?
Yeah.
You know, when I was living at his monastery, my little door in my little room was right next to his front door in the monastery. So a lot of times people came to my door before they'd go to his door. And let me tell you, some real strange people would be coming to that door. I mean, I remember one day they drug a man. There were people, and he was a Tibetan man, and they were dragging him like this, and he was like drooling. I mean, he was like he was in possessed with something, like a monster, and yelling, you know, just like crazy. I mean, it sounds funny. It wasn't. It was very horrifying. He was possessed. He was talking about insane. And, you know, his relatives had drug him to Comtal Rinpoche because Comtal Rinpoche is a very respected lama and he's a very extraordinary being. I think he's really one of the enlightened beings on the planet. And I remember Rinpoche came down and he had one room where then he was meeting with people and he asked for them to wait a moment and he went in and he sat down and he, you know, but I'm telling you, the rhythm, he was not hurried. He was not excited about this person at his door. He just said, wait a moment. He went and he got himself together. He walked very slowly past the whole scene, the whole incident. He went in his room. He got on his, you know, little thing. He sits on a kind of throne-like thing. And then he sent someone to get them. He did not get his rhythm disturbed. He was very concentrated. He had his balance. He wasn't startled. And then this, you know, I could hear it all going on in there. And after a little while, the man walked out. He was perfectly normal. But he was also had the the tendency to violence. I mean, it was a very dramatic scene. So I later asked Rinpoche, because, you know, Rinpoche just turned 80. And he works all the time. I mean, people are coming from early in the morning to late at night. You know, and then he's running this facility and monastery, and he has students, all kinds of things. And I said, how do you do it? I mean, how do you keep up the rigor of this life? You know, and he's a practitioner. I mean, he has his own practice, too. And he said, you know, Nuria, I really take every person that comes before me, no matter how they treat me, no matter what they say, or no matter what they do, they are like such a great teacher. They are like a stone on the path of enlightenment. But again, I'll tell you, even having a meal with such a person, he never gets disturbed by the conversation at the table. Very concentrated. You know, like even the way he picks up his food and he eats. Everything. Now, this is what I don't know about the erratic. I don't want to be erratic. I want to be in the flow like these beings are. How every motion is like poetry. You know, they're in space. You know, they're aware of a piece of bread and how they butter the piece of bread, and they're aware of how they bring it to their mouth. I mean, these are masters. This is how they live their life. And they're quite busy also. Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you get a little bit of a glimpse of that?
It's poetry in motion.
You have no idea.
It must be beautiful.
It's really exquisite.
We all have a perspective.
Really exquisite to see somebody like that in space. And he's very focused. I remember one day someone had brought a very old statue and they wanted him to bless it. And he was holding that statue like this. And he was he was walking across this area between the room where he would meet with people and the temple, which was, again, my doorway was there. And I saw him, and he was walking with his hands like this and looking at the statue, very concentrated, just moving in space. Just, he was space. But, you know, he's not, I've been with him now since 1993, and I've lived there for long periods of time. He's extremely consistent. This is what Anayat Khan's talking about, passion. You see, he's not like this, and he's not like this. He's like this all the time. No matter what, someone's running in, there's a huge tragedy, there's been an accident, people are wounded, and he's like, he's just like that. He's in the breath, he's balanced, he's in his body. And these beings are very practical. I remember one day he had come to visit, and we think he's coming. And he's coming. We know he's coming to the country. We hope that we're available here to receive him. But we were having tea one day at the museum here. And he was talking about this idea of attachment. And about how clinging and grasping, you know, how that creates suffering. And he's of the Nyingmapa tradition, and the Nyingma masters, they do marry. And also in other traditions, when they reach a certain level of attainment, they do marry as well. But anyway, Khamtul Rinpoche is married. And his wife was there, and she's quite a bit younger than him. And but they've been married a long time. They have a whole family together. And he said, it's like my wife. She's a young woman, and I'm an old man. And if she would want to leave me for a younger man, then I should be happy for her. What am I going to do? Beat her? Put her in a room? Lock her away? Then she would only be unhappy. And I also am creating very bad karma for myself. And could my happiness possibly come from her unhappiness? You know, it's just so logical, reasonable. But how many people cling to those things? I knew today was going to be like today. I knew I had a subject, but there were so many other things that came in to share, and so is it okay? Are people getting something from today? Okay. Jim, what about you? Pretty quiet back there. Is it okay? Heather? Rimagita, you're doing okay back there? Habib Aziz? Fuel for thought? Well, we'll go up and go to bed. Of course, he wants us up there with him. Shall we all go up to the bed? He is so attached to being in that bed with us. He just is, he wants his pack.
Loyal.
He's extremely loyal. He's a good boy. But we would like for you to... Have we lost Shamsuddin? What's going on with him? Is he back? Yeah. Does he need a little throat lozenge or something?
Maria, I've had several questions and thoughts, but this is one. I know our society... sometimes tends to romanticize madness because we have this whole romantic heritage and because so many of us struggled against sort of gray insanity when we were young, which was the more kind of bland insanity. But there is in Sufism, as at least I've heard it, many of us have heard it, this tradition of the Manzu, who is the apparently mad, but sage. I don't know whether that's simply our romanticism influencing what we hear from other cultures, or whether that's a real tradition within Sufism. But could you say something about the role of the Manzoob and whether that's just chaos or whether that's some kind of reconciliation of chaos with wisdom? Because that seems, that seems to be a different sort of path than the more the saintly path that you were just talking about.
I think they can be one and the same. I really believe that in truth, this path, when you take the path of enlightenment, whatever vehicle you're using, come on now. When you start to wake up, you really realize how crazy things really are, including oneself. And when you start to realize that, there is you start to live a life that is perhaps more active inwardly, and yet we must participate in the conventional sense outwardly. Does that make sense so far?
Sure.
So there is a, there is a kind of... I'm going to use the word a kind of schizophrenia to that in and of itself, where we're living sort of in those two worlds simultaneously. And I think we have to be careful with those terms. I think you're right. I think we romanticize it, and we also use that as an excuse for people's odd behavior when we've had a description here of what that odd behavior could be. So I think unless we're in that, the thing is when you're in the culture, like for example in India, you can see that and how that plays a part.
That meaning the Manzu.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that those really wise beings have, I think we all have that. Mabzud is kind of a person... For outward appearances may seem crazy, but they invoke, but they're acting with a wisdom mind. That's what that means. And sometimes we all have to do things that startle people. You know, that's the role of the mabzud. I think the court gesture is the mabzud. You know, we have those archetypes in other traditions as well.
Can I say something too?
Yeah, you would be a great person to speak to that.
In most cultures, especially in this one, I think of the artist is frequently like that.
Yes.
You know, because that the non-rational has something that can teach us or heal us or bring us to some vision. And frequently all those crazy artists are, you know, to romanticize them is good, because at least you can project on someone who doesn't have a linear, rational way that they give you something that is, you know, beyond or helpful. So drunken masters, like in Kung Fu, or, you know, you fight your best when you're drunk, or, you know, it's kind of that glimpse into what is not the rational thing. Sometimes the rational thing can poison you, you know, to be too rational. Like reading about Shamsi Tabriz or people like that, I don't think it's to romanticize in a bad way. I think it's to romanticize in a good way. You know, he was Rumi's counterpart. You know, because Rumi was book learning, and Shamsi Tabriz was like, woo-hoo. But anyway, that's what I mean.
I think of Sufi Sam, because he said that his secret was controlled schizophrenia, and you know his walk where he was like that. Some of you are familiar with that. And I was thinking of the rhythmic, that there's a rhythm to it, and it kind of Uranus, that it might not go the direction you think it will, but a lot of focus and concentration.
Yeah, I think sometimes Murshid Sam gets a really bad rap. I think he was a real master, and I think sometimes we kind of, you know, hear these other stories, and he seems like the dopey clown. I mean, you can't have accomplished what he accomplished and not be some kind of master. It's an unfortunate legacy, I think, that has been passed down, so I won't say more than that.
No, we love him.
But I think some of the things that he cited as doing, again, give permission to people that might not be altogether healthy to give. I won't say more. So this teaching today is from a selection of teachings that have been brought together on the breath. And this one, we're beginning the third gatha, the third series here. And this first is the first teaching, so it's nice that we're doing it here. Kind of at the beginning of our third year, the third gatha and the first teaching for January. So here it is. Mind is creative, and thought is living. Mind is creative, and thought is living. But out of what does mind create a thought? Out of the atoms of the mental sphere. But the current, which attracts the desired atoms to complete a thought, is the breath. Not that breath which is outwardly manifest, but that part of the breath, but that part of breath, the action of which is not felt by every man. The more length and breadth the breath has, the more scope it gives to the creation of thought. It is therefore that the thoughts of the sages and mystics who have gained mastery over breath are more substantial and complete in themselves And besides, they prove to be more expressive and impressive. Anything anyone wants to hear from that again?
Most of it.
You want to hear it again?
Yes.
The atoms of what? The phrase, the atoms of... Well, I guess you'll come to it if you read it.
I'll read it again, because I think, again, each sentence in and of itself is so vast and complete. Mind is creative and thought is living. But out of what does mind create? A thought is the question. And the answer is, out of the atoms of the mental sphere. But the current which attracts the desired atoms to complete a thought is the breath. The current kind of grabs that, you know, tunes to that. The breath. The breath can help tune us or elevate us to a certain pitch, or it can lower us to a more dense pitch if we need to. So, but the current which attracts the desired atoms to complete a thought is the breath. Not that breath which is outwardly manifest, but that part of the breath, the action of which is not felt by every man. Very subtle here.
Is he saying not felt by every man, or is he saying it's not felt?
It's not felt by every man. It's too subtle.
Oh, okay. So that's not.
Because then he goes on to say, the more length and breadth, more length and breadth the breath has, the more scope it gives for the creation of thought. And it is therefore that the thoughts of the mystics and sages who have gained mastery over breath are more substantial and complete in themselves, and besides, they prove to be more expressive and impressive. The breath, B-R-E-A-D-T-H, excuse me, the breadth of the breath is in its volume. It comes by the facility one has of breathing through wide nostrils and open lungs. The secret of the power of voice is also to be found in this. Right? I mean, we know that, like the great singers, the great orators, you know, have a great capacity for breath. And it can impress people in a certain way, the breath. And it can encourage people, and it can inspire people. You know, they're saying that about even the presidential candidates. Doesn't matter if they have the facts, all the information, and all the experience. Are they inspiring people? The length of the breath shows the length of life. If you don't think of anything else from this teaching, that's really pretty profound. The length of the breath shows the length of life. Lengthy breath is the sign of long life. This comes not only by wide nostrils and open lungs, but also by the accommodation that the body has for the breath. Not only the nose and the chest, but also the head and the abdomen. So again, that kind of internal yoga with the breath. There are some whose breath has volume, or breadth, but not much length. And there are others who have length and no breadth. But it is the balance of length and breadth of the breath, which gives balance to mind. Does that make sense?
Yeah.